craft and science that gave us the combustion engine, also gave us the iPhone, and also gave us open heart surgery. Surely our assessment of any one of those marvels will not be identical to our assessment of others. Not because any one item on that list is all good and the other items all bad, but because each of those technologies presents a wide array of possibilities and challenges, a full set of qualities and defects. For that very reason, the other factor that makes my task this Sunday and next Sunday quite impossible has to do with the fact that we tend to find it difficult to respond in a balanced way, in a fair-minded way, when we learn of new technologies. Some will instantly strike us as, wow, what a great new gadget, while others will instantly move many of us to exclaim, oh no, what now? And to be fair, my hunch is that there is good reason to presume that it is the second of those two responses, the oh no, what now response, that one would be likeliest to anticipate emanating from a pulpit, a Christian pulpit, in an environmentally sensitive denomination such as this. Given the juxtaposition of the two words, technology and humanity, it's only to be expected that a preacher in the Christian tradition will worry about the problematic ways in which technology will impact humanity, and that a preacher in that same tradition at this moment in time will also worry about technology's impact on the environment. Focusing on the Christian aspect of things, you need go no further than the story of Adam and Eve in the garden, where their preference for the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil trumps their desire for fruit from the tree of life. And yes, knowledge of good and evil is a very special sort of knowledge. I grant you that. But it's not the only sort of knowledge about which Scripture seems to exhibit at least some anxiety. Surely the Tower of Babel story further on in Genesis makes much the same point, as the godlike pride of those who sought to scale the heavens is rebuked as God scatters these presumptuous challengers to his unique authority, and yes, his unique knowledge. Nor, for that matter, is it surprising that the legend of Dr. Faustus, the Faust legend, grew up on Christian soil. Many of you will recall the cautionary figure of Faust, the overreaching professor who agrees to sell his soul to the devil in exchange for the kind of knowledge that far exceeds anything he would ever manage to find in the pages of his textbooks. Faust's bad end serves as a warning sign. This far, humanity, in your quest for knowledge and skill, this far, but no further. And yes, there are no shortage of technological developments that have been taking place in our lifetimes that can't help but send a small chill down the spine. Rarely does a day go by without at least one article crossing my desk describing a technology that causes me to wonder whether we might in fact be living through the formative days of a high-tech dystopia, a nightmare society that will threaten everything about human life that makes human life worth living. Just yesterday, as I was putting fingers to keyboards in preparation of this sermon, not only did I receive an article attributing to social media, things like Twitter and Facebook, the epidemic of loneliness among North American young people, but I was also gifted with a piece describing the way in which AI, artificial intelligence, was being used in China. Specifically, the article described face recognition technology. face recognition technology that allowed the Chinese police to track the article's author. This was an experiment. He hadn't committed a crime. This face recognition technology allowed the police to track the article's author as he attempted to hide in the midst of a city of 4.7 million people, slightly bigger than Nanaimo. How long did it take the authorities to find him in the course of this little experiment? Under 7 minutes. If that doesn't give you a chill, give yourself a pinch. And yet, I would be the world's greatest hypocrite were I to fail to acknowledge that the only reason I was able to read about that chilling experiment yesterday morning is because I have sitting on my desk a computer hooked up to the internet. And yes, it goes without saying that sermon preparation is probably not the first thing that comes to mind when we think of high tech. Nevertheless, technological innovation has absolutely transformed the way I work on sermons. It's not just that it takes me significantly less time to prepare a typical sermon than when I started out 35 years ago. It's also that the process of organizing a sermon, rearranging paragraphs is the obvious example. That whole process is far more straightforward when you're sitting with a word processing program than with a pad and pen. More wonderful still, when yours truly gets a thought vis-a-vis some quote or illustration that I kind of vaguely remember that I think might fit well within the sermon, that quote or illustration can usually be accessed in a couple of minutes, as opposed to a pre-internet world in which that quote or illustration would likely never have seen the light of day. I'm fairly certain that there are tasks most of you undertake on a regular basis which have been rendered significantly easier as a result of technological change. None of which erases the very real concerns most of us harbor vis-a-vis the new technologies that fill our world. Technological change often exacts considerable cost. It's not for nothing that the 19th century Luddites, destroyed textile equipment, equipment that was putting thousands of them out of work. Nor is there any shortage of instances of new technologies putting folks out of work here and now. Self-checkout, anyone? All of which explains why I can be neither an uncritical booster of technological change nor an unrelenting critic of all technological change. Make no mistake about it, to wade into the question of technology and humanity is to wade into an issue fraught with complexity. And while I most certainly do need to offer and will most definitely be offering words of caution and concern vis-a-vis some of the most recent technological developments, I guess I'm unable to offer those words without first making the point that while some Christians may well be honorary Luddites, despisers of all things technological, it may well be the case that the God we worship is anything but a Luddite. Consider that rather obscure biblical episode Paula shared with us from the second half of the book Exodus. Most of us will be familiar with the story told in the book's first dramatic half, including all the events depicted by Cecil B. DeMille in his unforgettable The Ten Commandments. Many of us, however, will have checked out of that particular biblical book by the time chapter 31 rolls around, in which God is giving instructions to Moses concerning the construction of the tent or the tabernacle that will journey with the Israelites as they traverse the wilderness. It's here in the course of providing precise specifications for the building of that tabernacle, It's here that God references two of the Israelites, one of whom in particular, Bezaleel of the tribe of Judah, is said to possess exceptional skill as a craftsman. The money quote, of course, is the one in which God informs Moses that God has filled Bezaleel with the Spirit of God, with ability and intelligence, with knowledge and all craftsmanship to devise artistic designs, to work in gold, silver, and bronze. When I speak, as my sermon title this morning speaks, in praise of technique, in praise of technique. It's to just such skill that I'm referring. Nor will it do to claim that technique is different from technology, since all technical prowess requires not only skill, but as God says of Bezaleel, requires also intelligence with knowledge. Realizing that there is a difference between the knowledge of a Bezaleel and the knowledge behind such technological marvels as laparoscopic surgery or the internet, the fact remains that true craftsmanship is unthinkable apart from knowledge, including the knowledge unavoidably gained by craftsmen in the very pursuit of their craft. Nor should the opening chapter of Genesis be overlooked in that regard. I realize that I've already mined Genesis for the Adam and Eve story and their unfortunate choice of fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, as well as the Tower of Babel story. Fair enough, both of those stand as cautionary tales. All the same, I can still recall an especially illuminating moment in what was, I now realize, the first Bible study I attended in a church rather than in a synagogue. It would have been the spring of 1979, and I was still living in Toronto during what was very much my seeker phase. The prior fall, I had begun attending Bloor Street United Church and had signed up for a seeker-style study group the lead minister, Cliff Elliott, was launching. Early on in that study group, either on the first or second evening, Cliff had us work our way through the first chapter of Genesis with its news of God having created in the beginning. At any rate, when we got to the sixth day, technically the afternoon of the sixth day, when God creates human beings, Cliff paused to make the point that we actually know but one thing about God when that information is handed to us. What is that one thing? That God creates. And surely, he argued, to claim that human beings are made in God's image is to suggest, whatever else it may suggest, that we too are made for creativity. And I realize full well that the biblical tradition, the Christian tradition, staunchly warns us against overweening pride, never tires of cautioning against human presumption. But it is a tradition that offers that warning within the context of a recognition of all that is good and life-affirming in human life, above all the many places at which human creativity shines through. And I'm reminded here of the ongoing controversy between environmentalists and a certain school of economists. Environmentalists, rightly so, remind us of our limits, our boundaries, our need to respect the earth in all of its splendor, but also all of its fragility. And yet economists, such as the late great Julian Simon, remind us that each newborn child is not merely a mouth to feed. That includes you, Aurora. Is not merely a mouth to feed, a consumer of resources, but also a creative set of hands and mind, ready to contribute to humanity's ongoing efforts at expanding the resources available so that humanity might not only survive but thrive. None of which, none of which ought to blind us to the very real challenges technologies, simple and sophisticated alike, pose to a sin-sick human race in which even the best discovery has the potential to be exploited by those with less than savory intent, a broken world in which even the most life-giving of technologies is almost guaranteed to unlock unintended consequences, consequences that cannot always be addressed in a timely way because they cannot always be anticipated. Please, 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 do not take anything I have said this morning to indicate that I am unaware of the challenges new technology will always pose, of the disruption to human lives, as well as to the natural world, which new technology almost inevitably brings in its wake. And yes, the very real possibility that we may one day face, who knows, maybe this is that day, that we may one day face the unveiling of technological avenues that will truly undermine human community and human flourishing. None of us ought to be naive about the very real challenge we face. Challenges, at least a small handful of which I will try to explore next Sunday. But my point this Sunday, as someone who would make a very poor Luddite, as someone who is under no illusion as to how many of us would even be alive this morning, minus so basic a medical technology as the one Alexander Fleming, the discoverer of penicillin, stumbled upon nearly 91 years ago. My point this Sunday is that awareness of the challenge, indeed awareness of the deeply troubling aspects of technology, ought always to be placed in the wider context of gratitude. Gratitude for the inescapable fact that we together, you and I, are members of a vast human network that includes creators and builders, researchers and discoverers, blessed with a wide array of gifts and skills that have been placed at the service of human flourishing, enhancing all of our lives. And yes, in my humble opinion, a failure to express gratitude for that wealth of human creativity, a failure to offer our praise for the vast diversity of human technical skill and creativity, would be a failure not only to offer to sisters and brothers what is rightfully theirs, but to withhold from God rightful praise for the boundless creativity of this human race, the race fashioned in God's image, in God's own boundlessly and astonishingly creative image. Final thought. I had a dilly of a time finding hymns for this morning's service. I'm not upset about that. I'm not sure how many hymns we need, how many hymns I personally could stomach, celebrating humanity and its decidedly checkered capacity for creativity. And yet even an old-style Reform Calvinist sort of guy like myself, I was struck at how bleak most of the hymns are that touch upon humanity, capturing our brokenness without making much of an attempt to capture our grandeur as God's image-bearing creatures. And so, as some of you will have noticed, I eventually settled on an Epiphany hymn, a hymn that speaks of the light God yearns to shine on all humanity without exception. And so let me be clear on this. At the end of the day, what Faust gets wrong, what Dr. Faustus gets wrong, isn't that he is meant to seek knowledge. What he gets wrong is the fact that he thinks he needs to turn to the devil in order to gain that knowledge. But it is the God of light, God from God, light from light, very God from very God. It is this God who has promised to bathe us in the light of truth, and to fill us with the capacity to live the truth creatively and faithfully. May it be so. Amen.